content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading selections from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll dig a little deeper into the April issue of Our State magazine, the theme of which features articles all about North Carolina's revolutionary heritage. And the name of the first article is A Revolutionary Road Trip. From towns to battlefields, these 17 sites across our state still echo with the footsteps and sacrifices that helped to forge a new nation. And our first stop is Halifax. The Rebel Provincial Congress, meeting at Halifax in April of 1776, told its delegates to the Continental Congress that they could vote for independence, the first explicit statement of support for revolution by any colonial legislature. Halifax was a hub for men and military supplies throughout the war, and the British Army occupied the town for 10 days on its way out of the state in 1781. Years later, both George Washington and the Marquis de Lafayette passed through. At historic Halifax, you can tour the sites where the Congress met and where the British crossed the Roanoke River heading for Virginia. And the picture here is of reenactors that are bringing the past to life with demonstrations at the historic Halifax State Historic Site. And they're shooting muskets in this particular photograph, dressed in historical garb. Our next revolutionary stop is Edenton. By the dawn's early light, revolution stirred. In 1774, North Carolina's first colonial capital became the site of the first women's political protest in America. Penelope Barker and 50 others signed a resolution to boycott British goods in defiance of Parliament and King George III's taxes. And the photo here is overlooking Edenton Bay. There are three cannons that were brought by a Swiss captain who dodged British ships to deliver them in 1778. And in the distance, there's the Penelope Barker House, which was built in 1782 and which now serves as a welcome center and museum focusing on the Edenton Tea Party. And the picture is taken at either sunrise or sunset. The water is reflective of the sky, which is hues of pink, lavender, and blues. Our third stop is Bath. On May 6, 1775, a rider from Edenton galloped into the port town of Bath with a dispatch. British redcoats had attacked Massachusetts Minutemen at Concord's Old North Bridge and on Lexington Green. The war had begun. Many local men joined the Continental Line or enlisted in the militia, while seafarers helped bring in supplies and ammunition. Just north of the Pamlico River on Bath Creek lies North Carolina's earliest town, founded in 1705. One of the state's oldest standing homes, the Palmer Marsh House, was built circa 1751, while the Bonner House sits on land once owned by Bath co-founder John Lawson. And there are pictures of those two homes, definitely both in colonial style. One does have a large, wide porch, and the other one has just a little entrance that has a covering. Drone footage or drone shot looking over the harbor at Bath. We'll head on from there to Newbern and to the Tryon Palace, which was built in 1770 for Royal Governor William Tryon. Our first permanent state capital was considered one of the finest buildings in the American colonies. It served as the official residence of British governors in North Carolina until 1775, when Governor Josiah Martin fled the palace and rebels seized it for their headquarters. In 1798, a few years after the capital moved to Raleigh, the Georgian-style palace burned to the ground. In 1959, after the historic buildings and formal gardens were faithfully recreated, it opened to the public. And the photograph in this is an aerial view of Tryon Palace, the renewed Tryon Palace and restored, and then also of sort of an English labyrinth garden with statuary and lots of tulips. Next up is Brunswick Town, Winnebago. One of the first acts of rebellion by an armed force in the colonies took place in Brunswick Town on the Cape Fear River. As part of the Stamp Act, struggle over a tax on documents and printed materials, hundreds of people confronted Governor Tryon at his home here in 1766, 7 years before the Boston Tea Party. Customs officers were compelled to agree not to enforce the tax. Brunswick Town State Historic Site features the exposed foundations of buildings that saw raids by Spanish privateers in 1748 and Lieutenant General Lord Charles Cornwallis in 1776. He is not guilty of burning the town, as once believed. Next is Moore's Creek in Curry. Tryon's successor, Royal Governor Josiah Martin, coordinated with Lord Germain, King George III's Secretary of State, to send an army to retake North Carolina first among the colonies, in part by claiming that thousands of loyalists would join them. Only about 1,500 showed up in February of 1776. At Widow Moore's Creek, they found the bridge deplanked and greased, but Scottish Highlanders drew their broadswords. They charged around a curve into a surprise artillery and musket fire from some 950 militia. Almost all of the loyalists were killed or captured, blocking the British invasion. Moore's Creek National Battlefield has remnants of the original route, followed by the loyalists and patriots, plus a reconstructed bridge and earthworks. In Montgomery County, the Flora McDonald home site resides. Flora McDonald became the most globally famous person in North Carolina when she and her husband arrived from Scotland in 1774. As Outlander fans know, following the 1746 Battle of Culloden, she helped a Scottish prince escape the British by dressing him as her yarn spinner. After her loyalist husband's capture at Moore Creek, she ran the plantation here for 2 years. Their exact home site is unknown, and historians have disproved the myth that she left behind two dead children. Park by Cheeks Creek, however, and a narrow wooded trail leads you north on public land that was once part of their plantation. And moving on to Sanford, to House in the Horseshoe, named for the Horseshoe Bend in the Deep River where it was built circa 1772, this residence, also known as the Alston House, was owned by Colonel Philip Alston, whose band of militia was attacked and captured by loyalists here in 1781. Later, four-term Governor Benjamin Williams lived here and turned the estate into a cotton plantation. Today, the State Historic Site features colonial and revolutionary era antiques. Elizabethtown. Just off Broad Street, spot Tory Hole, that's in quotes, the slope where many retreating loyalists launched themselves into a deep ravine near the Cape Fear River during a surprise attack by patriots on August 27, 1781. Moving further west, we come to Hillsborough. Hillsborough was the scene of dramatic events related to the Regulators, which are pre-revolutionary protesters against provincial government corruption and excessive taxes, including the spot where six were hanged. During the Revolution, it was a camp for both the British and Continental armies. A Loyalist raid captured the North Carolina governor from Hillsborough in 1781. Among the many period homes in the town is that of William Hooper, the state's only remaining residence of a Declaration of Independence signer. And they show a picture of his gravestone, and he died at age 49, but it shows that he is a signer of the Declaration of Independence. Moving further west to Greensboro, the Guilford Courthouse. Guilford Courthouse National Military Park protects about a third of the site where the British won the largest revolutionary battle in the state, but lost many men, contributing to the loss of the Southern Campaign. Start at Hoskins Farm to follow in the footsteps of the British as they scared off the first line of militia. Northeast, the second line of militia proved sturdier. When the Continental Regulars of the third line pushed back, a vicious melee ensued, although Cornwallis did not intentionally fire on his own men to stop it, as legend holds. Going even further west, to Winston-Salem, to Old Salem. No site in the state brings you closer to the feeling of life during the Revolution than today's Old Salem. The Moravians objected to war on religious grounds. Built as the commercial center of their 98,000-acre Wachovia tract, Salem hosted and supplied both sides, earning abuse from both. In 1781, the British Army marched down Main Street, where Cornwallis stopped to visit with Trago Bag at his store, which is still open today. And it shows a picture here of a horse-drawn carriage riding through Old Salem Museum and Gardens, and it passes structures like the Single Brothers House, built as lodging for unmarried men. In Lincolnton, at Ramsour's Mill, in June 1780, as Cornwallis was planning to invade North Carolina, 1,300 Loyalists gathered on a small hill in modern Lincolnton and ready to join his forces. With a Patriot militia army moving in, a closer unit of 400 decided not to wait. The battle devolved into friends and family members fighting hand-to-hand before the Tories were driven into a panicked retreat when a marksman killed a captain. The hillside was littered with bodies. Now it's the site of three school buildings, but landmarks of the battle remain, including a mass grave. Then there's the Over Mountain Victory National Historic Trail. The 330 miles trail stretches over four states, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia, and it retraces the Patriots' journey to the pivotal Battle of Kings Mountain in South Carolina. In Morganton, we have Quaker Meadows. Cornwallis invaded Charlotte in September of 1780, sending Major Patrick Ferguson and some 1,100 men west to rally Loyalists and to protect Cornwallis's left flank. In response to Ferguson's threats to cross the mountain and attack Patriot homes, around 1,200 men assembled at Charles McDowell's home in Quaker Meadows, including those now called the Overmountain Men. See the site of the Oak Council, where the colonels decided next steps and part of the home site. And there's Rutherfordton, the Green River. After learning that the Overmountain Men were coming for him, Ferguson began a slow retreat. Misled into thinking he was aiming for South Carolina, the Patriots headed that way and camped by the Green River. A North Carolina colonel splashed across and corrected them. The leaders sent their fastest men ahead, and they trapped Ferguson on Kings Mountain after a 40-hour pursuit. Bradley Nature Preserve contains a stretch of the original trail, the campsite, and an enslaved person's cemetery. In Franklin, there's Cowie Mound. Kaya, or Deer Town, was one of the first Cherokee towns in the Little Tennessee River, a trade and diplomacy center with 100 log homes, farm fields, and orchards. It's centered on a ceremonial mound built around 600 Common Era, topped by a round council house. When North Carolina militia responded to Cherokee raids with a campaign of destruction in September of 76, they burned the excavated town, trampled the crops, and stole or destroyed the food stores and livestock. A riverside observation deck offers a view of the water and the mound, and more of the town's story. Okay, and our last theme-related article is entitled The Strength of Sisterhood. In Charlotte, a Daughters of the American Revolution chapter has been getting things done for 127 years, and it's just getting started. Luann Wisnicki takes her time dusting the desk in the corner of the room. Clad in gloves and careful not to use any chemicals, she polishes its surface with a cloth issued to her by the Charlotte Museum of History, ensuring no speck of dirt or occasional ladybug remains. The walnut desk's drawers, arched cubbies, and secret compartments make it more artifact than furniture. Dating back to 1765, it sits in the study of the Rock House at the museum. The Rock House, the oldest surviving house in Mecklenburg County, was completed in 1774, and it was home to Hezekiah Alexander, a Charlotte statesman who helped to lead Mecklenburg County to independence. His desk has a special meaning to Wisnicki, the current regent for the Mecklenburg chapter of the National Society of Daughters of the American Revolution. This is one of the desks where the idea of freedom was born, that would change the course of our country's future and eventually birth a nation. Wisnicki and her fellow chapter sisters, including Elizabeth Nesbitt Miller, a direct descendant of Alexander seven generations back, don't take their connection to history for granted. In most museums, you can't touch anything, Wisnicki says. When we clean the Rock House, it's nice to enjoy a sense of trust. You are in the spaces where historic things happened, and that's a very cool feeling. That sense of preserving the past for future generations motivates these women to put on their old clothes each spring to clean the Rock House. Some polish windows with newspapers, while others straighten bedsheets. Shelley Kiker, the immediate past regent, current historian, and DAR school's chapter chair, focuses her efforts on the kitchen house, where she's evicted more than one bird's nest. It's just so easy to imagine in that space how people lived and what their daily life was like, says Kiker, who led the charge to restore the kitchen house in 2023. By throwing a 125th anniversary gala, the chapter raised $60,000 to replace a rotted structural beam, to rechink the logs, and stabilize the hearth and chimney to make it functional. The restoration was crucial in making cooking demonstrations possible again for the 10,000 annual visitors to the Rock House, according to Nolan Dahm, exhibits manager and lead historian. The DAR, they're just always there, he says. They're always showing up. Prior to the kitchen renovation, the Mecklenburg chapter was also integral in preserving the Rock House during the 1950s. With a total of 13,462 community service hours in 2025 alone, the 267 women who make up the Mecklenburg chapter are still at it. Whether they're restoring historic structures, making lap quilts for veterans, marking graves of American Revolutionary War patriots, or supporting educational efforts, these women are not ladies who lunch. They're ladies who get things done. Membership in the NSDAR is awarded to women who can prove they are direct descendants of someone who helped achieve independence during the Revolutionary War. Kiker talks of her patriot, Thomas Hoover, as if she knew him personally. An ancestor on her paternal grandmother's side, he provided sundries for the militia and is buried in a private cemetery in Lincolnton. Kiker and her father visit about once a year and clear brush and vines while they're there. Because some of her ancestors lived in the Steel Creek area of Charlotte, Kiker was more inclined to join a Charlotte chapter of the NSDAR. Organized in 1898, the Mecklenburg chapter is the oldest chapter in North Carolina and the second largest in the state behind Wilmington's Stamp Defiance chapter. Kiker liked the fact that she could hide amongst the Mecklenburg chapter's 36 committees until she figured out how she wanted to be involved. 5 years after joining, she became regent and was fully dedicated to the organization's three pillars: historic preservation, education, and patriotism. Kiker was so drawn to the NSDAR's mission of service that she encouraged her daughters, Carson Garvin, and her mother, Diane Gannon, to join. You know, I have these resources of money and time, and these are the things through DAR that I can focus on, says Wisnicki. That's the thing that separates NSDAR from other service organizations. No matter what your interest, there's a niche where you can get involved, she explains. It's taking our pride in our ancestors who were all connected and wanted things to be better. We're like that today. While she was regent, Kiker's love of children, she's a grandmother to six, inspired her to strengthen an existing relationship with La Escuelita San Marcos, a bilingual parent collaborative school in Huntersville. Upon meeting with the school's administration, she discovered they wanted to create a STEAM that stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, Arts, and Mathematics room in the basement of Hopewell Presbyterian Church, where the school meets and whose cemetery is where many of the chapter's patriots are buried. Shortly after, the chapter raised enough money to not only redo the floors in the STEAM room, but also the entire school. Since then, the chapter has collected supplies for the students and paid for their caps and gowns at graduation. At this point there, they, the staff at La Escuelita, feel comfortable saying, "This is what we need," Kiker says, adding that this partnership also fosters patriotism in the students, many of whom are first-generation Americans. It's Saturday morning, and Wisnicki has her old clothes on again. This time she's cleaning grave sites at Redding Springs Cemetery with a soft bristle brush in one hand and a bottle of D2 biological solution in the other. She brightens tombstones so veterans can receive the recognition they deserve. The chapter adopted the cemetery a few years ago and maintains the property. The people before us helped create what we have now. This is a good way of honoring those who came before us, says Wisnicki, whose patriot is buried in New York. I'd like to think there are people caring for other people's patriots as well. Caring for veterans is one of Wisnicki's favorite things about the NSDAR, so she never misses the Queen City Honor Flight, a free flight from Charlotte to Washington, D.C., that takes veterans to visit the district's memorials. Laura Morris Gust is usually right there with her, waiting for the veterans to arrive, American hand and flag in hand. As cowbells and bagpipes ring in the air, two women carry a banner that reads, "Welcome home, Honor Flight Veterans. Thank you." Followed by a parade of veterans accompanied by their caregivers, many of whom are their grandchildren. While the crowd erupts in cheers, Geust takes her appreciation a step further. "I jump into the hallway and shake people's hands," says the first vice regent. "I want to look in their eyes and not just make noise, but make a connection." In addition to welcoming them home, members of the Mecklenburg chapter handwrite thank you notes for every Honor Flight veteran, up to 140. It's a moving experience that often brings veterans to tears. "I want them to feel the love because many of them were never welcomed home," says Geust, who also crochets poppies for veterans. It all serves the mission of service to America. That seems to be the sentiment among all the daughters. They want to honor their ancestors and the county, the country they helped create, in whatever way they can, even if it's simply by dusting a desk sitting in a corner. And we'll wrap up with another article from one of the new columns that's every month, North Carolina Naturally, Exploring the Landscapes and Living Things in Our Great Outdoors. This one is entitled Room to Breathe. In Weymouth Woods and in other mature forests beyond the Sandhills, we find trees that offer a lesson in coexistence. Nature is a scramble, some say, a dog-eat-dog world, a competition, survival of the fittest. The truth is, sometimes nature comes in tender forms. It comes politely. Sometimes, for example, trees say, "Pardon me," to each other. They give one another a little space. A phenomenon called crown shyness, we find it by standing among our oaks and maples or beneath our pines and looking up. There we see the treetops, their crowns. If they're practicing crown shyness, their upper branches won't touch. Instead, rivers of sky wind through the canopy, great meandering snakes filled with sunlight and stars. Not every place has such polite trees, and not every tree grows politely. We aren't sure why trees in some forests behave cordially while others act like children scrambling to the top of a hill, tumbling and reaching, pinching and twining limbs. When trees give each other room at the top, the rest of the forest has room to breathe. Sunlight pours through the gaps to the floor, nourishing plants and animals below. Rain trickles through. Leaf-chomping insects have a harder time leaping from tree to tree. Wind passes through safely as branches don't bump and twist and break in the jostle. In North Carolina, forests filled with the sky-worn streams of crown shyness grow across the state. At Weymouth Woods and Southern Pines, a sliver of our state's once mighty pine savannas, the trees grow tall and give each other room. There, light can fall into the soft, sandy soil and needles below, where wiregrass grows strong. Turkey and blackjack oaks return favors with longleaf pines, bowing but not kissing where the wind blows. At Weymouth, everyone has clearance to breathe, space to see, the capacity to feel the world without also feeling the jumble of a crammed room. In young forests, crowns still push and shove so trees can trip over each other, blocking out the sky. Some older forests can tangle elbows and shoulders, too. If you want to find crown shyness, keep looking up when you're among trees in your yard and parks. You'll see it eventually, the map of sky shimmering between the outlines of trees. It turns out, as with people, it takes the same amount of effort, maybe even less, to be polite as it does to slight and claw. It takes the same knowledge, too. For trees, mutual kindness depends on the temperament of the trees around them. Polite trees are more likely to grow into polite forests. It also depends on the temperament of their own species. For example, longleaf pines are more likely to grow politely than many oak species. Still, in places where crown shyness establishes, like among the pines of Weymouth Woods, other trees, even impolite oaks, will often get in line. For trees and for people, politeness fosters harmony, giving space to listen or watch or let the wind blow, to let someone come through the door first or show gratitude. Makes life easier for everyone when the storms come. In a sputtering, grasping world, it can seem difficult to find space to give. Well, there's plenty of sky to go around. We have time for one quiz question about the pirate lore on the coast. In 1717, Blackbeard and his crew captured a French vessel called La Concorde, which became his most notorious ship. What new name did he give the boat, whose wreckage was discovered off the coast of Beaufort in 1996? Was it A, Queen Charlotte's Revenge, B, Queen Elizabeth's Revenge, or C, Queen Anne's Revenge? If you said C, you are correct. Well, that means our episode is up for today. We've run out of time. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be joining us next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Our State Magazine is also available as a podcast at our website at ncreadingservice.org. For questions or comments, give us a call at 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.